Echo. Oh, there we go. Okay. Hi, everybody. My name's Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you all for the invitation to be here with you today at the Blue Ridge Group. Looks like it's a beautiful sunny day there in Virginia. It's sunny here, too, but it was a 13 below wind chill factor this morning, so a little cool around this place. I would rather be there with you, that's for sure. Like I said, my name's Scott, and I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is March 1st, 1976, and I have a home group. It's the Aurora Big Book Group in Aurora, Minnesota, and I have a sponsor, and I talk to my sponsor every single week, and, you know, it's a wonderful experience. I can tell you, I went a little while without a sponsor, and that is not a wonderful experience. Billy told me to qualify a little bit, and then we're going to talk about some traditions. And I just got to tell you that I took my first drink. I had my first drunk. I don't even know when I had my first drink. I mean, I grew up in a working class family, and you know, you could have a sip off the beer whenever you wanted to, but not more than a sip, you know. So, but I can tell you, had my first drunk when I was about 12. And that seems to be a pretty common age for my generation. It really triggered off something that I would have never thought, you know, when I went into that evening with, you know, and got drunk that night. I would have never thought what was going to happen to me, you know, in just a matter of a few short years. By the time I was 17, I had a nickname, and my nickname was not Shorty or Slim or Smokey or anything like that. My nickname was Delirious, and I lived up to my nickname the very best that I could. I didn't get it by accident. Usually I'll take you through the dictionary definition of delirious, but I won't tonight. And by the time I was 23 and I had came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a niece who lived right close to us. And to the family, I had become known as the thing that lived in grandma's basement. So in 4 short years, I had went from delirious to the thing that lived in grandma's basement. And both were very descriptive of the way I lived my life. And also, I think, very descriptive of what alcoholism is doing to my life. I got drafted in 1972. I got out of the Army in 1974. I had pretty much become a daily drinker by that time. In fact, my last station was AP Hill in Virginia. I got out in July of 74, and I moved in with some guys down in Duluth, Minnesota. And September 1st, I was supposed to report back to my job. And of course, I got drunk and I missed that date. And that kind of set off the whole thing, just started. I could never get to work. You know, I would go to work one day a week, 2 days a week. If I was lucky, I could get in 4 days, but I rarely ever made a full week of work. And between September 1st of 74 and April of 1975, I had been arrested multiple times, mostly on driving charges and intoxication. I didn't have a penny left of my name. And in April, I got arrested at work on a felony charge and got suspended from my job and ended up in jail again and ended up having to move back home with mom and dad. And that's where we get the thing that lived in grandma's basement. Because, you know, I took my drinking to their house, you know, and because I couldn't stand to do that, when the weather got warm, we had a campground and camping was free in those days at the city campground. And I basically lived in my car as often as I could throughout the summer until it got too cold, in and out of court all the time, you know, because of course you're never going to admit guilt on a felony charge. And you know, but things just kind of turned sour. And eventually on December 23rd, 1975, I was convicted and sentenced on this felony charge, and the sentence was pretty severe for what I had done. But, you know, at those times, today it wouldn't have been looked at the same. But, you know, it was a sentence of 5 years in the state penitentiary, but it was stayed for, luckily for me, for only 3 months in the local work farm. And then the judge went and stayed the sentence until after the holidays and told me I had to report. I had to report for to the work farm myself or they'd come get me. And I'm just jumping through this rather quickly. But through the summer of 75 also, there was this alcoholism counselor for work who chased me. Every time I showed up in at court, this guy would show up. And I mean, you know, I had visited him once before that, and his interview with me went kind of bad. You know, he was asking me all those questions that alcoholism counselors like to ask. And eventually I just kind of got tired of it and told him it was really none of his damn business. And that was kind of the end of the thing. But this guy was shrewd. He didn't turn me into the employer and say, get rid of him. He hung in there and he chased me for the next several months, 13, 14 months. Every time I showed up in court, there he was. And I just resented this guy more and more, you know, redheaded, red faced, you know, full of this beaming smile and all the wonderful things. And, you know, and I thought, just get away from me, leave me alone. You know, this, I don't want nothing to do with this stuff. But while I was in the work farm, well, I won't go that far yet. We'll stop and tell you a little bit about my last drunk. Seeing as how I was home and I got to bring that wonderful Christmas gift home to my parents on December 23rd to tell them I was going to be locked up in jail for 3 months. I tried to behave, but it wasn't easy. You know, I mean, you really try, especially when you see the faces on the family of the people you've harmed and you can see the harm you've done. You know, I wasn't always capable of seeing what I had done to others, but that day I was able to see the harm I had done to them. You know, it was so obvious, so right in my face. So I tried to behave throughout the Christmas, but of course on New Year's, I had to go out. You know, I had to go out and see what my buddies were up to. And go to the party and have one last big deal before I went to the work farm. And I was standing in the door getting ready to go out and my mom was right there and she said, you better stay home. You know what happens to you every time you go out. You see, I had turned into the category 4 drinker that's in the two wives, you know, who is more or less insane, however they describe it in there, you know, that insanely drunk. That's what was happening to me at the end of my drinking. I had absolutely no control. And I would go out and have a few drinks, no tolerance, and I would black out and I would get belligerent. I would just get crazy. I couldn't explain it. So she wanted me to stay home, you know, and I had learned enough about me that I didn't stand in the door and argue with her and tell her it ain't gonna happen this time. I just left, I just went. And you know, she had to be scared to death because sometimes I would leave and I wouldn't come back for days. You know, I wouldn't come back for days. You never knew what was gonna happen. Once I poured a drink in me, there was absolutely no knowing what was gonna happen next. It was always an adventure, but usually not a very nice one, you know. So I went out and the bars were all pretty quiet. And then I found out there was a big party at the local community center. And for some reason, nobody had invited me. So of course that hurt my feelings. Here me, I'm such a nice guy and I'm going to be going away for months, you know? So I went to this party and I was in a total blackout. I don't remember even being there. And the next thing I know, I come to, and it was hard for me to understand where I was at. I didn't know what was going on. I could hear people talking in the background, and my arms and my legs were restrained. And when I opened my eyes, the ceiling was only just a couple of feet away from where where I was at. So I was obviously laid out, and finally I came to, and I was in an ambulance, and I actually convinced those guys to bring me home. You know, that's probably, they wouldn't do that nowadays, but back in 1975, they actually did bring me back home. You know, I explained to them that I already owed the emergency room money from my last visit, and we won't go into that drunk, but, you know, and they took me back home. You got to give the neighborhood something to talk about. You know, my God, I'm not going to be home for months. So, you know, one last grand entrance into the driveway at, you know, at the Johnson household with the ambulance. Why not? You know, it gave them all something to talk about for a while anyway. And I don't remember anything. And I came to the next day, which was New Year's Day, and I could hear people upstairs. And I woke up with a bad hangover. And I'm not a hangover kind of a guy. I don't know if I just kept drinking or if I just had that kind of resilience because I was young. But this morning I had a bad hangover. And I went in the bathroom and I looked in the mirror. And I had two black eyes and a big cut down my lip. And I looked like heck. You know, it felt like somebody had been marching around in my mouth. And I looked that way too. But what I remember more than anything is described on page 8 in Bill's story. And when I first read this, I thought, oh, my God, how it's like somebody was in your back pocket or something. How could anybody else know that this feeling? And it says that no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And that is the way I felt that day. I knew that I was going to die a drunk. I knew that this is the way life was going to be. There was no hope. I felt absolutely alone and in the dark. You know, it was terrible. I knew nothing about recovery. The only thing I knew about AA was a couple of my drinking buddies who were still drinking. You know, that kind of information isn't too useful if you're trying to get well. the one guy was showing me his medallion from the treatment center while we're sitting drinking beer, for God's sake. You know, I didn't know how much good it was doing him. He seemed to be getting drunk right alongside of me, but, you know, of course, January 2nd, my mother delivered me to the work farm. Now, most mothers are lucky enough to deliver their sons to the college or university or maybe off someplace, you know, for an adventure. Well, I guess it was an adventure. And she got to deliver me to the work farm, to the Northeast Regional Correctional Center. And, you know, I never once for many, many years, even in sobriety, thought about how that must have made her feel. You see, I had that narrow viewpoint that I couldn't see beyond the end of my own nose. Never thought about how any of my actions ever made anybody else feel. So anyway, there I am in the work farm. And finally, this goofy alcoholism counselor catches up with me again. And he kind of lays down the ultimatum. He says, Scott, the railroad says that you can either go to treatment or you'll be fired. But he was a smart man. And he said, I'll come back next week and you let me know what you want to do. And we can work out some things, maybe get you out of here early. Several different things. So I checked around in the work farm about what the heck this was all about. And one guy said, you got to go. The food's a lot better than it is in here. Doesn't beat much to beat jailhouse food. Another guy said, you got to go 3, 4, 5, 6 times before you ever get anything out of it. And I got to wondering what he got out of it because he's sitting in here with me. And I didn't even think I wanted to go once, yet anything like 3 or 4 times, you know. But finally, a man took me off into the corner and he sat down and he told me his story. I had asked him about this business. What is this? And he took me in the corner and he told me his story. And he told me about his alcoholism. He told me about his recovery, and that he had a sponsor and he had a home group and he was busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and things got really good. So when they got really good, he thought, well, maybe I just don't need to do this quite as, you know, maybe I don't need to go to that many meetings. You know, maybe I don't need to go over there and make coffee, let somebody else do it. Maybe I don't need to talk to that old sponsor quite so often. And you already see where this went. And he ended up not going anywhere or talking to anybody and had a drink. But he's one of God's angels. There he was, telling me what happened to him and telling me that, yes, there is a way to live. People like you and I don't have to live like this anymore, that there is hope for us. So it helped me make the decision to go off and to go to the spin dry. And my whole world changed. My whole world changed. The man 12-stepped me, and I never saw him again after I left the work farm. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know if he ever got sober. But he changed my life with the simple message, the precious message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, you know, the only thing I can tell you about treatment is that when I did my fifth step, I had an unexpected thing happen to me. I had a spiritual experience. It isn't because I had done such a good job at what they were doing in there. It was God at work through another human being, and I had this big spiritual experience that changed my life. But I never did anything else. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous after that, but I never worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous at this point. Let me tell you about my very first AA meeting. It was in a little meeting just close to town here, and on Sunday night, and I went into this meeting, and I had been in the treatment center, and I had been taught that I am a chemical dependent. A chemical dependent was the term they used in those days, good or bad, I don't know. But they, at this group, they had a group conscience. And the group conscience was, this meeting is a closed meeting for alcoholics. And the woman down the table, there was about 30 people in this meeting, a roundtable discussion. And the woman down the table said, my name is so-and-so, and I'm a chemical dependent. And the chairperson stopped the meeting and said, what is that? This is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This meeting is for alcoholics. If you're not an alcoholic, one of us will go sit in the kitchen with you. But, you know, and it, as the discussion went on, she was an alcoholic. And of course, the meeting went on. It taught me something very quickly, that I was no longer a chemical dependent. I don't know that I ever really was, but that I was an alcoholic. And that one of my problems in life had always been dissension. You know, I would fight against any conformity. But this time, for some reason, I learned that, you know, if I want to get sober in this outfit, maybe I got to do what they're doing. And I'd never been a chemical dependent since. I've always been an alcoholic. Now, let me tell you about the second meeting I went to. My first two meetings were very exciting. My second meeting, which was my home group at the time, it was easy to have a home group back in those days around here. There was one meeting about every 15, 20 miles. And, you know, and it, so the one that was closest to you, that was your home group. That's where you went. And this group, I walked in there, and this group was full of a bunch of old men. Old men, some of them were, I can tell you this, none of them were as old as I am now, but they all seemed old. When you're 23 years old, everybody seems old, but there were some older guys in there, and some of them were wearing plaid double knit polyester clothing, And a couple of them had on the worst toupees that I have ever seen in my life. It's like somebody put a piece of grass on their head or something, you know, and they'd have bent over it, it fell off. And I'm thinking, you know, I just think now, thank God that nobody said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, because I had to ran out the damn door. I didn't know what they had, but I didn't want any of that. But, you know, they were a loving bunch of guys, and it was a good meetings, and they were hosting a conference that year, and they kept bugging me to go to this conference. And they had some good speakers coming in, Wesley P. from Florida and Don N. from Moorhead, people who had been around a long, long time, been around 30 years at that time. And I'm going to meetings with these people, and I'm not sure I like this stuff or not. I've got this spiritual experience. It's pretty good. I like that. But, you know, slowly through daily living and self-centeredness, this good feeling that I had starts to disappear. And in its place comes, what am I doing hanging around with this bunch of people? Why am I going to all of these meetings? I'm following along the same process that the guy that 12-stepped me told me about. And I'm following the same path as he is, you know. And pretty soon I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about drinking. See, I believe the obsession starts first with my criticisms of AA, my criticisms of sponsors, my criticisms of whatever, of the world around me. And then eventually, through that self-centeredness, then the obsession starts to come back in. And I started to realize that I have this coming into my life. And I don't tell nobody. And I'm planning the next drunk. But I go to this conference, and instead of having this drunk, I go to this conference because they were able to persuade me to part with $10 and go to this thing. And I heard this Wesley P. talk, and he talked about being a two-stepper. And, you know, something in his talk struck my heart and made me realize that I'm in danger. That I am in danger of going back to my old crazy ways. I am so close. And that next Monday night at the meeting, I did something very unusual. I would like to tell you that I made a surrender, but I think this is more than a surrender. I spoke to them and I asked them for help. I humbled myself and asked them for help, which I think is a little different than just me surrendering inside. I'm surrendering to you. And I surrendered to you, Alcoholics Anonymous, that night. And you gave me two gifts that night. One was called the book Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the guy with the worst toupee that I have ever seen before or since, came up to me, and he's holding a big book, and he says, do you have one of these? And I said, yes. He said, then I suggest you open it and you start following directions. And when it says pray, you pray. When it says write, you write. When it says to do something, you do it. And when you get confused, you call me. And I started my journey through the big book the summer of 1976. And you know what? I've never looked back since. It's a life-changing process. The other thing they did is they elected me co-chair of the meeting and started my journey into service. Co-chair in that meeting meant I didn't have to do anything. I sat by the chair and got to be a big yuckety muck, you know, but it taught me about making commitments. Then he didn't show up one night, and I had to learn how to make coffee in that thing to look like a keg, you know, and find a topic to talk about for the night. But it started me on a journey in service that took me through the general service, through the third legacy process for being a GVR and being involved in the district as a GSR, becoming a DCM, becoming area action committee person, getting involved at the archives, becoming the archivist, And then eventually becoming an alternate delegate and a delegate to the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, just because they said, maybe you should make some commitments to your own recovery. They changed my life. Twice in one night, they changed my life. Little did I know. All I knew is I was scared I was going to drink again. And I know I'm burning up my time like crazy here, and I haven't even got to any of the traditions. But a little bit I did. I also want to tell you, in this Monday night meeting that we went to, the guys with the double knit polyester, one night a fellow showed up there, and he wasn't one of us. He was a member of Overeaters Anonymous. And he wanted to know if he could join the group and come to the meetings, because there wasn't any Overeaters Anonymous. This is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, I saw the group conscience in process. And they were sympathetic. But they explained to him what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And that, you know, hope that he could do what he could do. And perhaps he was eligible for Al-Anon. We didn't really go into that. But, you know, they showed me again that Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. And it's a beautiful thing to see. Sometimes it seems harsh, but it's not really harsh. It's a spiritual process that we need to learn to protect Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes we have to be the person who stands up and says, this is a meeting for alcoholics. Whether it's an open meeting or a closed meeting, it's still a meeting for Alcoholics Anonymous. I know there's a lot of groups around now who like to hold open meetings so they can open up the door and talk about whatever is going on in the world. But that's not what AA tradition tells us. That no matter what kind of an AA meeting we're holding a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that has to do with recovery from alcoholism, that we do have a primary purpose. I'm going to try to zing through some of these things quickly. You know, in tradition one, it talks about our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And that's also what these guys were doing when they asked about the chemical dependent and the overeater. They were trying to preserve their unity. Because if we allowed the non-alcoholic in, maybe some of the alcoholics would have left. Maybe it would have been another, a fight at the next business meeting over these things. They had a group conscience. And that's really an important thing to have, is a group conscience. Our common welfare is our recovery through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be unified. And you know, I recommend everybody look at the long form of the traditions in whatever you can find them, in the back of the big book, in the 12 and 12, wherever you can find them, and take a good close look at the long form. And I also highly recommend Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, and study not only the whole book, but the section on the traditions is masterfully written by Bill. And it takes you through the history of why we have these things. And I also want to give our Wednesday night meeting on AA Comes of Age online. I think this is it, a little plug. If you get a chance, get the information from Billy. We have a lot of fun and we learn a lot of stuff. And the other thing I'm going to put a plug in for, and if there's time, I might talk about it, is in the back of AA Comes of Age, there is a section called Why Alcoholics Anonymous is Anonymous. And it is fantastic. Bill takes you right through the 12 traditions and talks about why we are anonymous, why it is important for us to remain that way. Tradition two talks about, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And I love this, because anybody that gets involved in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to find out a little bit about this tradition. And I think this tradition Tradition one kind of describes the problem that we have in AA, I think, and that's being unified and keeping our common welfare first. In the 40s, AA was growing so fast without any principles like the traditions, and the groups were making rules of who could come and who couldn't come, and you know, they had all kinds of stuff going on. So groups were folding up just as fast as groups were starting. We were starting to destroy ourselves. And that's when Bill started to put together these traditions to say, we do have a problem and we need to be unified if we're going to be successful in carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in tradition two, he goes a little bit further. He talks about a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. And for me, that means I need to be a part of a group. I need to be a part of that voice. Because I think God does speak through these groups. God speaks, but we need to gather together and discuss Alcoholics Anonymous. And he expresses himself, a loving God. You know, I've been in a couple of them where that was the group conscience wasn't so loving. So I don't know that God was expressing himself. I think maybe some personalities were expressing themselves, but not God. And sometimes that becomes a dominant thing. An individual can take over the group conscience if we let them. You know, all you got to do is think about Bill's story when he got offered the job at Towns Hospital. And how he thought, you know, the laborer is worthy of his hire. This is when AA is brand new. We don't even have a big book yet, as far as I know. And the group conscience, some brave soul stood up to Bill and said, you know, Bill, that would destroy us. That's good for you, but it would destroy us connecting Alcoholics Anonymous to this hospital through you. It would destroy AA. So somebody stood up in the group conscience. They were all in agreement to the guy that started the deal, you know. And sometimes we got to be the guy that stands up and says the things that need to be said. Not an easy task. I'm never going to tell anybody that's easy. And it isn't everybody that can do it. But the more we are aware of these principles, I think the easier that becomes. And we can do it with some kindness and some tolerance and some love, that there are no AA police. You know, thank God for that, or I'd have been arrested. I know that for dang sure. You know, that there's ultimate, and it talks about trusted servants, that we need to have trusted servants in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the beauty of getting involved in the service structure, that I learned how to be a trusted servant. At first, I wasn't very good at it because I didn't know how to serve. And I would like to bring my opinions always to the table about what I thought about everything and influence the group conscience as much as I possibly could. And I have since learned that what I need to do is bring the information and let the group talk about it and make their decisions. And it's possible for that to happen. Even though my ego tells me they need me, you know, they've got to hear what I got to say. But the truth is, the group conscience works through all of us, not through just one of us. And that leadership that we have through our servants is very important. Some people say we don't have no leaders in AA. We have some leaders, and I call them anybody that's willing to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. Then we got tradition three, which I've kind of already went over. And, you know, for me, I think tradition three took place that night when I surrendered to that group and I asked them for help. Because, you see, as it says in How It Works, that's the night I gave myself to this simple program. I wasn't just joining AA like you joined the Legion or something. I surrendered. I gave my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's when I met the requirement. And, you know, in the long form of tradition three, it doesn't use the word desire or requirement. It just says that Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics, and we need to try to allow all alcoholics to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and not make any rules to keep people out, keep alcoholics out. Tradition four, that's self-governing. You guys have your format for this meeting. Our group has its format. Our group has changed its format, I think, 3 or 4 times in the last 46 years. You know, it's changed its meeting format several times to suit the needs of the group conscience. And you know, the other part about four is affecting other groups as a whole. And whenever our group tries to make a decision, we need to always try to consider, does this affect the other groups in the district or AA as a whole? And give it some thought, you know, because sometimes we want to show people, even as a group, we can have an ego. You know, ours is the best group. We get into this competitive kind of thing, and we think everybody should do like we're doing, or they're doing it wrong. And no, you know, we need to allow those groups to do whatever they're doing. And not to have any, try to not do anything that would affect them or AA as a whole. And so what does go on in our group does matter to me too, also about, are we affecting AA as a whole? What are we doing in our group? I guess that's why when I close, I'm going to close with some questions like that. So I'm not going to get into them right now. Tradition five, we have one purpose, just one purpose. That's to carry our message to Alcoholics Anonymous, to alcoholics. We have no other purpose. And what is the message that we are carrying? My understanding of it is that we're carrying the message of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the recovery program outlined in the pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And that there is hope for people like you and I. And you know, so I guess I don't know if tradition five is in so much danger right now or not. I don't really know. I think most people that are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous are alcoholics. I think what we see and what we get upset with, or at least I do, is the language that's brought in sometimes, and the labels that are brought in sometimes. And I think, you know, that they are a threat to our primary purpose, that some people want to treat it like it is a dumping ground and that we can take care of all of the world's problems. And we really can't. We really can't do that. It's impossible for any group of people to do that anyway. But anybody that wants to take our principles and run with them is certainly welcome to. That's what Bill says in the traditions. Take our principles and use them and develop your own recovery program and help the people that you're trying to help, you know. And six really is just an extension of five. Except that for me, six talks about that I can easily be diverted, and it lists some things to be diverted for. But when it gets right down to it, I can be diverted away from the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous by my big fat ego and my self-centeredness. And I'm going to back up to tradition five. There's a couple that in the long form of the traditions, in tradition five, it says that each group is a spiritual entity. I love that. And, you know, that's a question you got to ask. Is my home group a spiritual entity? Are we carrying this message of Alcoholics Anonymous? And in step six, it talks about the spiritual aim. And the spiritual aim is sticking with the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is our spiritual aim. To protect AA against me and my ego, you know, that's got to be done. And I'll tell you what, you might think I'm an egomaniac today when I'm talking to you, but I'm feeling pretty humble and afraid and a little bit nervous about it all. But you see me when I'm alone with a couple of people, I can be a horrible egomaniac, taking inventories and saying how bad everybody is and all of these things and being judgmental and critical. And I have to really watch. I have to take my own inventory every night, thank God, and every day when those things come up, and put them aside and say, God, forgive me. God, show me how to live better. We read something today in a book in our meditation, and it said, believe in your prayers. I just love that. Believe in your prayers. Whatever your prayers may be, believe in them and they will work. And one of my prayers is that I watch for self-centeredness and for egotism and judgmentalism and criticism. Tradition 7, I was scared to death of this one. You know, this is another one. We see traditions in action when we come into AA, not just like I did where they stopped the meeting and everything. But there's an AA group. We're walking into a group. They are unified. They're passing around the basket. There's coffee to drink or whatever. So we actually are seeing traditions in action at our very first meeting. At least I did. I didn't know that that's what I was looking at when I walked through the doors, but that's it. God, they were happy, joyous, and free. They were having a good time. I was seeing recovery, and I was seeing unity in action. And in Tradition 7, when I came in, they left the basket in the middle of the table, and there would be 30, 35 people at the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, there would be $3 in the basket. And after some group conscience, they decided to pass the basket. And you know what? There was usually $35 to $50 in the basket. Makes a big difference. What do they do with that money? That's really what the Tradition 7 is about. What are we doing with the money? Are we passing it on? Are we sharing it with the other entities in Alcoholics Anonymous after we pay our bills? And Tradition 7, this thing about self-support was frightening to me. You see, when I came to AA, I hadn't had a job for 13 months. I had ran out of unemployment. I was bumming off mom and dad. I owed them a lot of money, and there was no accounting for it. So it was part of my amends. Part of my amends to them was paying them back, learning to be self-supporting. I needed to learn how to do that. I was an immature. I didn't even have a checkbook. That's how immature I still was. And now nobody has a checkbook, I guess. I don't know. Everybody lives off of cards and debit cards and whatnot. But so I needed to learn how to do that. In long form of 7, it says that it's our spiritual heritage. That we need to watch what we do with that money so that we don't start fighting over it, that we give it on, pass it on, make sure that it's used for AA services. And when I say AA services, to me, that is about carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, wherever it is, whether it is in China or Africa or at the Blue Ridge Group. So we carry, our dollar carries a message someplace on this planet. And really, when I throw that dollar in the basket, it's no longer mine. It belongs to the group conscience. 8 talks about paid workers, and thank God we don't have paid workers. We have paid workers at General Service Office, but we have no others. You know, it says something like freely we have received and freely we give in this tradition. And that's what happened to me in the work farm. I experienced part of Tradition 8 in the work farm. The man sat down and spent an hour talking to me and told me his story. If he'd have said that will be $20 now, I wouldn't be here. If we were charging for our 12-step call, none of us would be here. You know what would happen if we got into charging for 12-step? Billy would charge so much, and he would put hang a shingle out someplace, maybe even get some, do a little advertising, and Lynn would hang her shingle out and she would charge some, and pretty soon we have competition going. And then when they went to the meetings, the rest of the group would get to judge which one of them was better. Some of us would put them up on pedestals. Others would hate them for what they were doing. That's what happens if we bring professionalism into 12-step work. It divides us immediately. 9 talks about having no authority in AA. There's nobody that can tell you, you got to get out of here. You're really a goof. And thank God for that, you know, because they'd have told me to leave because I was really a goof when I walked through the doors. It talks about we have a lot of servants and that we can't expel anybody. That's not to say that we can't ask somebody to leave our meeting for being disruptive. I mean, we've had people with mental health issues at our meeting, and they make so much noise that we've had to ask them to leave. And then, of course, then they made even more noise. But sometimes we have to do those kinds of things because it's more important that we have an AA meeting for everybody else. That's our purpose, is to carry the message. And, you know, we're not expelling anybody from AA. Come back when you can. When you've got a little bit of handle on things, you know. What else? In the long form of 9, it talks about universal respect for our servants and for one another. Universal respect. Give that some thought in your meditation. I know I do. Whenever I happen to think of long form of tradition 9, I see those words, universal respect. Am I treating everybody that way? Oh, I'm out of time already here. All right, almost out of time. All right. And 10, no opinions. And I'd like to tell you more about the Washingtonians if there was more time. But the Washingtonians was a fellowship just like us in the 1840s. Even more successful than us. Less recovery program. And no traditions. And in 3-4 years, they were basically gone. The name was still around, but the organization itself had failed because they got involved in all kinds of things. They got involved with professionalism. They got involved with having opinions on slavery and on temperance and on all kinds of things. And that, you know, and they destroyed themselves. And they had minimum of 150,000 members in just those 3 years. AA took 5 or 6 years to get to that many. My question always has been, what happened to that 150,000 alcoholics when that organization dissolved? Where did they go? What happened? And the other thing I guess I like to talk about with 10 is that what am I talking about before the meeting? When does the meeting really start? Am I talking my political views outside having a smoke with somebody or just out talking before the meeting? And I hear it all the time is on Zoom meetings. Well, the meeting hasn't started yet. We can talk about whatever we want to. Is that true? How do those discussions affect somebody who's new or who's somebody of another opinion? Just questions I always have. For me, the meeting starts when I get in the car. So I'm going to the meeting, or if I'm going to push the button to come to the meeting, I'm not going to talk about those kinds of things. 11, to me, is simply, you know, the anonymity. The anonymity of Alcoholics Anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films, media, including this media, not so much this kind of exactly, but I mean, Facebook and whatever, those kind of media. And 11 to me is a lot about respecting others and the level of anonymity that they want and respect them anyways. Learn to respect other people. It's a spiritual principle that I've had to learn. And 12 talks about our spiritual foundation. And 12 really is the result of all of the other things. Those middle traditions, they're all about making sacrifices for the good of AA, putting AA's importance over my own importance in recovery, that without AA, I can't exist. And to me, simple, as I think the simplest form I can put tradition 12 is, it is respect for the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, to place them before any personalities, to respect the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what 12 means to me. And it is supposedly we all, when we go through these things and we make these sacrifices, we also become just a little bit more humble in God's eyes, and make us just a little bit easier for us to serve another alcoholic and to carry the message. And again, I know I don't have time, but I really highly recommend everybody get AA Comes of Age and read Why AA is Anonymous. Bill will take you through this much more eloquently than I have tonight. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful writing of his. And I just want to close with this. This is kind of a little personal test. And I, you know, write it down if you want to, but ask yourself these questions when you get a chance. That's what my old sponsor always did. Everything was in the form of a question. When I had a problem, he had a question, you know. and so I've kind of learned to ask these questions. And I ask them of myself, but I hope you reflect on them. What am I saying in Alcoholics Anonymous? What are my words? What are my actions saying? Not only in AA, but in life, but in AA pertaining to these traditions and AA's unity. What do my actions say about me and about Alcoholics Anonymous? Do I stand up and serve when there's a chance to be of service? Do I continue to make commitments? I've been here 46 years and there's been very little time that I haven't had some kind of a commitment, whether it's treatment center, whether it's speaking at a meeting, whether it's hosting one of these meetings, but making myself available to serve AA. What do I say when I'm outside of Alcoholics Anonymous? What kind of an example of AA am I, not only to my group, to the people I sponsor, to my family, and to the community? You see, especially when you live in a community of 1,500 people, people know you're an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And no matter how big a community you live in, some people know that you're an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. What kind of an example am I today? Am I carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or have I changed the message to suit myself and I'm carrying my message and maybe forgotten what the real message of Alcoholics Anonymous is? Do I make myself available for 12-step work? Because that's what keeps me fresh and alive, to be able to sit down and talk with another drunk. Am I a loving, tolerant, kind, and understanding member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or am I judgmental, critical, always mad, always feeling threatened that, you know, that this is, you know, I'm out to get you? Did I join the police force in AA? God, I hope not. You know, do I stand up for AA's principles? And I've already talked about that before. Am I willing to stand up for AA's principles? And you know, that's not so hard to do when you belong to a group that has group consciences that says, when this happens in the meeting, the chairperson will do this. So that the chairperson isn't just speaking for themselves, but they're speaking for the group. What kind of an example am I? And I guess that's what I'm going to end it with. What kind of an example am I? And I just really want to thank you all. God bless you all. And thank you for my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I pray that we all just simply take care of this beautiful spiritual gift that we've been given called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.